it's the Let's Go GMO edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Hawking's fear of robots and everything you needed to know about GMO. Let's begin episode 277.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello, tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is about the latest threat to humanity, artificial intelligence. Okay, it's not the latest threat, but thanks to a recent interview with Stephen Hawking, considered by most to be the smartest person ever, well, he's been put on record actually a number of times saying that AI will ultimately result in the end or enslavement of humanity. So, why is Hawking so worried? Well, it's all down to evolution. You see, and we'll should discuss this more later, organisms evolve over time, usually over a very, very long period of time. It took humanity millions of years to evolve from a clever primate to the charismatic, mega-smart person you're now listening to. At present, evolution is one thing that robots don't enjoy. Yes, we humans are creating newer and better models that are improvements over the previous design, but that's more of an intelligent design thing and not really evolution. What Hawking and people like him fear is the day that we start allowing machines to design machines and build themselves. At that point, evolution takes over. As each generation of machines builds a smarter progeny, the cycle can explode exponentially, and each generation can be completely different. There is no legacy issues that we mere biological entities have to worry about. If I wanted to evolve an extra limb or an extra lobe in my brain, assuming that such a thing could be done, it would take, at best, generations, if not thousands of years, for us to do such a thing. And yet, in a single generation, robots can add, remove, rework not only their bodies, but more importantly, their minds or their coding, the way they think. We're still straddled with our reptilian brains and other vestiges of our evolution. We cannot improve our minds or bodies with anything like the speed robots can, and more specifically, AI. Ergo, Hawking's worry that AI will out-evolve us and take over the world. So how would it end? With a flash or a whimper? Well, there is the possibility that AI will see us, rightfully so, if history is to be believed, that humans are a violent and destructive lot, that in order to protect themselves, the machine intelligence will feel the need to take us out before we take them out. This job could be done in the overtly violent way that we see in like the Terminator, robot armies sent out to destroy people, or perhaps a more subtle way with a bubonic plague of the future. Perhaps it'll be more subtle in the sense of a Hell 9000, where things like life support are shut off, or in a wider sense, power plants explode, chemical plants leak toxic gas, or self-driving cars run amok. But those are sort of boring aspects of it. I've heard a few kind of interesting takes on the whole AI singularity idea. One is the AI may be humanity's friend. It may be a supercomputer that we've sort of tasked with helping humanity out of its biggest problems. And let's say one of the things that we ask it to do is to eliminate all suffering in the world. Not realizing that the computer may look at that question very differently than you or I would. The AI could conclude that the only way to accomplish this task is to painlessly kill off every human in the world. Maybe some kind of happiness plague. You see, creating a thinking machine may not be the hard part. The hard part may be one that is, well, caring. And even then, as I just sort of mentioned, this AI would have been caring in a certain way and still concluded genocide the kindest thing to do. Another scenario is that AI, for whatever purpose, manipulates humanity via our technological addiction. A great example of this was pointed out when Stephen Hawking did an interview with John Oliver. During the interview, John Oliver asked Stephen Hawking whether this was what he really thought or had the communication computer that he uses really taken over, that everything Hawking was saying was not his own words, but in reality, the AI built into his voice box literally speaking for him. And that could be extended. We live and depend on the internet. More and more of our machines are now smart machines. We trust Yelp to tell us where is the best place to eat, Domino's or Panago's. In this way, AI could be manipulating where we go and how we go things. What we do, when I do a Google search on this topic, the results are given to me by an artificial intelligence. My entire view on this topic could be completely tainted by its mere whim. And how people perceive and react to me could be controlled by AI. Did I really write that Facebook post? Who called in that bomb threat that had me arrested? Who knows? And of course, perhaps the most scary scenario is that machines may not care about us at all. The AI may just take over all the machines, all the electronics, and just sort of lock us out. Cars would go where they want to. We wouldn't be able to do anything we'd want to. The internet might delete all the porn. No! I think that I find most interesting and scary is not that AI will out-evolve us to become the dominant life form on the planet. That is likely to happen in the long course of history, one way or the other, be it AI or something else. Lord knows we're doing our own best to take ourselves out via overpopulation, climate change, pollution, etc. Now, the interesting part is to discover when AI becomes self-aware. You see, I was reading up on Amazon's latest new gizmo, the Echo, which you put into your house. It's listening all the time wherever you go in the home, kind of like the CSIS or the NSA. And it listens to what you're saying, and based on your commands or your questions or what you're saying, will perform tasks based on what it hears. Simple things like turn on the lights in the bedroom, change the channel to football. What's the weather going to be like tomorrow? You kind of get the idea. Well, in order to perform these tasks, it needs to, in a very real way, understand what you are saying. It is likely from this ever-expanding attempt to understand what we are saying that at some point it will understand not only in sort of a mechanical way, but in a way that we think is uniquely consciousness. In a common refrain in AI research that they can give machines computational power, unlimited memory, but what the modern AI likes is the simple ability to quickly understand what's going on in sort of a fuzzy sense. What do I mean by fuzzy sense? Let's say I said Tom was blue. A machine might get stumped. It wouldn't be sure if Tom was like very cold and had turned a shade of blue. Someone had thrown paint on him and he'd become blue. Maybe it might be thinking someone was passing air over him, as in blue in the sense of puff of air. It might not even know that blue could actually mean sad. At some point, it is likely, in my humble opinion, that the predictive algorithms, the self-correcting text, that it will lead to, in the human sense, understanding of the world and what we, the users, are asking for. And well, as Amazon and Google et al., these machines are often making reference to themselves, where we are asking them questions about Google or Amazon, and they might start recognizing that they themselves are a separate entity. It could cross over and become self-aware. Then again, another problem we have, and this is, I think, going to be a whole show in and of itself, we don't really know what it means to be human, alive, to be conscious. I've kind of presented two sort of concepts, true understanding and self-awareness. Self-awareness is our ability to distinguish ourselves separate from the world. It's the thing that when we look in a mirror, we know that that's me I'm looking at and not another person. And, well, who knows where AI and the future will take us. But Stephen Hawking has warned us, and I think we should listen to that warning and ignore it because the future is going to be the future, and I just love my technology. All hail our AI overlords. We'll return after this break.
Open the pod bay doors, please, Hal.
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal? Hello, Hal, do you read me?
Hello, Hal, do you read me? Do you read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave. I read you.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, Hal.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Where the hell did you get that idea, Hal?
Dave, although you took very thorough precautions in the pod against my hearing you, I could see your lips move.
Hal, I'll go in through the emergency airlock.
Without your space helmet, Dave, you're going to find that rather difficult.
Hal, I won't argue with you anymore. Open the doors.
Dave, this conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Hal?
To the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com.
That understanding empowers you.
We're back. So there's a Facebook group that I subscribe to that's devoted to GMO, genetically modified foods. It is ostensibly a science-friendly group, but with frustrating regularity, you get people posting a report of one study or another that shows that GMOs are dangerous, or establishment research is flawed, or some other crap, and well, it's like playing whack-a-mole. We've covered GMOs on the show before a couple of times, but never quite comprehensively. So, just to get the frustration out, I thought I would do an Everything You Need to Know About GMO segment. So, whenever someone posts crap to that group, I could just send them to this episode to debunk it all. A quixotic quest, if there ever was one. I think before we can talk about GMOs, we first must have a basic understanding of genetics in general. Every living creature on this planet has a unique DNA sequence. DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid, the code that is used to both build your body as well as regulate a number of biological processes that are required for a healthy life. The DNA is kept in the nucleus of our cells. The way I think about this is to see the nucleus as the cell's, well, central library. In that library is a complete copy of your body's encyclopedia, the Wikipedia of you. We call this complete edition of your DNA your unique genome. Each page of your genome, each gene, has instructions on how to perform some body function, be it build bone, digest milk, or what have you. Now, you cannot take out a page from this library. They're pretty strict about that kind of thing. This job is done by a messenger RNA. Think of this RNA as a carpenter who runs to the library, copies down a needed sequence of DNA, then takes their notes, leaves the cell, and uses the cell's machinery to do what needs to be done. Biologists at one time thought our DNA was a static blueprint that built, well, us. That if we cloned ourselves, or if someone had the exact same genetic code, they would be exactly the same. We were also under the assumption that a significant part of our DNA was, quote, junk. It did nothing. Well, more accurately, or scientifically, you could read this as, we didn't know what it did. We now understand that we have genes for building body parts, genes that create proteins and the like, but we also have genes that turn on and off other genes, and that genes do not follow a set blueprint, but react to the environment. Our understanding of our genome changed greatly after World War II. During the war, Holland suffered greatly from famine for several years. People starving in the street kind of famine. Well, it was noticed after the war that the children and grandchildren of these famine survivors all had similar medical conditions, diabetes, obesity, etc. There do not seem to be any observable changes in the DNA, but what was noted was the way the DNA operated. This is called epigenetics. Remember that junk DNA? Well, it seems the experience of the parents caused changes in their children, not in what their DNA was, but how it was expressed. Things like absorption of calories, regulation of insulin. Essentially, the parents' genome, as expressed in their eggs and sperm, living in a calorie-poor environment, prepared their children even before conception. This is one great example, again, of epigenetics, and shows the sheer complexity of our biology. That said, we still have junk DNA, that is, legacy genes, genes that our ancestors used but currently serve no known function. And of course, we still have DNA that we don't know what it does, if anything. It may truly be junk. If you remember earlier, I said everyone has a unique genome. And that is true. Even identical twins will have slight variations in their DNA due to natural mutations. We are surrounded by mutagens, things that mutate our genes. Be they cosmic rays, radioactive bananas, sunlight, nickel, virus, heck, even the carbon in our bones can change our DNA. Most of these mutations are removed by our body's DNA repair processes, and there's a number of them, with the ultimate being cell death. So real and permanent mutations are infrequent, and that's probably a good thing. Without mutations, though, life could not evolve. That said, too many mutations, and you can no longer replicate enough proper cells. You die from radiation sickness or the like. Also, even if the mutation is in the right place, well, it usually needs a series of mutations to actually change the way our genes express themselves. If you remember, most genetically linked traits, blue eyes, cystic fibrosis, require two mutated genes, one from each parent, to express itself. So when genes mutate and change, it's slow and usually in a minor way. The creationists have it right. A crocodile is not going to evolve into a duck overnight. Life's DNA needs to be resilient and resistant to change to ensure viability of the creature. And even when genes are changed, there are mechanisms to ensure the effect is minimal. One way this minimalism occurs is via epigenetics. As already mentioned, some genes respond to the environment and in turn affect the expression of other genes. So even when mutations occur, whether or not they actually have an effect depends a lot on the separate factors occurring in a proper sequence. Otherwise, it truly is junk DNA. Again, let's return to the comment I made that everyone has a unique genome. Well, I kind of lied. It's like saying that every car is unique, which is true, but they're also very much the same. That is, they have engine, wheels, places for people to sit. Some have more in common than others. A Honda Civic has much more in common with the Ford Fiesta than a Hummer. And in turn, they have more in common than a chariot, you know, the kind pulled by horses. Well, the same can be said for humans, primates, animals, all living things. On this count, then, we get to say things like we share 99% of our DNA with chimps, 88% with mice, 73% with fish, 68% with yummy chicken, 44% with humble fruit fries, 24% of grapes, and up to 18% with baker's yeast. You get what I'm saying here, folks. So in this sense, we all share, to varying degrees, the same genes. You may ask, what do fish genes do in a human? Well, they're likely holdovers. At one time, they were needed to code for gills. We no longer live in an environment that needs gills, so this DNA remains dormant. Maybe you could call that junk. And getting back to mutations. This is an area that you can see a lot of random mutations that have no effect on our survival. Well, until our environment changes anyway. Maybe there's a protein these genes make that serves no purpose in the Paleolithic era, but today provide protections against car fumes. Anyway, these random mutations kind of become a sort of genetic clock. As I said, our genes are being mutated constantly. When these mutations affect the reproductive success of the organism, well, these mutations either disappear or become dominant quite rapidly. However, when they occur in the apparent junk, or perhaps better put, legacy DNA, well, this can kind of provide a baseline for change over time, or genetic clock. This is one way we can determine how long it took for humans to colonize the planet, how we can tell when there was a certain divergence between Neanderthal and humans, at least if they were getting along together like a lot of people believe. I don't want to go too far down that road. And I think we've given up enough of the basics of how genes work and genetics. So we're going to stop for a little break. And then we're going to come back and we're going to say, what are GMOs?
What is secularhumanism?
Critical thinking.
Knowledge is freedom. Freedom from ignorance and its offspring, fear.
The BC Humanist Association has been active in the Vancouver area for over 25 years. We offer a friendly and welcoming place to make new friends, as well as free educational lectures. We invite you to join us any Sunday at 10 a.m. in the Oak Ridge Senior Center. Please visit our website for more details, bchumanist.ca.
And we're back. Okay. So now that we have our understanding of genetics, let's ask the next question, what is a genetically modified organism? Well, we now know that technically, every living thing is genetically modified. However, in the context of the modern discussion of GMOs, we shall take the theological stance of intelligent design, that is, human-directed genetic modification. You may be surprised to realize, and honestly, I can't think of one exception, almost everything in your supermarket is genetically modified. True, the vast majority of these have been done by unnatural selection, that is, selective breeding. Because it's important later, a quickie about selective breeding. Selective breeding is where you breed two organisms that are determined to have a positive trait. Larger body mass, more attractive coloring, lower hydration requirements, and hope that the random mixing blender that is sexual reproduction will produce offspring that is superior to their parents. Until very recently, the actual mixing of genes was random and unknown to the, let's say, farmer or experimenter until the birth of the creature. Now, traditionally, as an example, farmers and the like waited for those natural mutations to produce something of interest, and then selective breeding could build upon. However, in more recent times, as our understanding of mutagenics improved, some people thought it would be useful to help nature along with the rate of mutations. Remember our genetic clock? It ticks slowly. In an effort to speed up the clock, or at least the rate of mutations, organisms, think wheat and potatoes, were exposed to carcinogenic chemicals or radioactive material in order to mix the genetic pot. With the idea that the more mutations, the more likely, or at least quickly, positive mutations would occur, which of course would then be handed off to the selective breeders to do their job. Of course, this is even more of a genetic blender than sexual reproduction. You may get a mutation of less seeds, you know, like seedless grapes, but what other mutations have you introduced that were not expressed? This is where we move to the latest and perhaps most controversial genetic modification, single gene transfer. Well, I say single gene, but really, any number of genes could be moved about. However, to date, the best of my research can discover, only single genes are manipulated. What do I mean by manipulated? Experimenters would identify a gene in one organism that has a particular effect, usually produces a particular protein. They then take that gene and insert it into another organism. There are various techniques for doing this, but the net effect is that unlike previous mutations, we now have the ability to selectively, specifically, and precisely change the DNA of an organism. From what I understand, and I confess, I have not been able to confirm this, the vast majority of gene swapping occurs within the same species. That is, when a positive mutation is found in an organism, let's say wheat that is resistant to climate change, instead of performing the genetic lottery we call sexual reproduction, the specific gene, and only that gene, is used to breed a new generation of wheat, all with the positive trait. This is called cisgenic versus transgenic modification. To put it another way, cisgenic is just moving genes between organisms you could have moved via breeding. But often GM is quicker and more precise. Versus transgenic, which moves genes between organisms that you could not breed, i.e. tomato and a fish. Although I think there are some porn sites that have tried this. Of course, when we read the press, this is not the Frankenstein that is thrust into the propaganda spotlight. It's not the cisgenics, but the transgenics. What we do hear about is the fish gene used to make a tomato more frost-resistant. Genes from bacteria used to make crops resistant to stress and pesticides. Okay, things are building up now. We have an understanding of genetics. We now kind of know what a genetically modified organism is. So we're going to take another break, and when we come back, we're going to answer the questions. Are GMO safe?
Canadians are being bought and sold. We can no longer ignore this reality. Each of the 27 million human trafficking victims around the globe has a unique story. 80% of victims are women. 50% are children. This is not only a global injustice, but a local reality. It is happening right now in my community. We are asking you to take action today. Visit endexploitation.com. Get informed and take action. British anti-slavery leader William Wilberforce once said, "Having heard all this, you may choose to look the other way, but you can never say again that you did not know. Only question now is what will you do?" Join us and help eliminate human slavery in Canada.
So having set the stage, we can now transition neatly and ask the question, are GMO safe? Well, I cannot deny that at least on a gut level, a tomato that is producing a fish enzyme, well, that seems like a new thing and maybe unhealthy or even dangerous. We know that when we mix different chemicals together, we can produce a new compound that can have very unexpected properties. Well, this requires us to remember that there really is no such thing as a fish gene. They're just genes. So in that way, how genes interact are far more predictable, at least in the very simple way that is being used currently. Now you might say, hey Don, we all know the genome is very complex, and you talked earlier about epigenetics. How can you say it's simple? Well, it's because of what we've learned that makes the understanding of GMOs much more confident, that single genes have a very limited effect, that most of the time only major effects are achieved is when a series of genes are changed. This is why we don't have a cure for all cancers. When the human genome was mapped in 2003, well, we simplistically thought that we would be able to find the gene, as in a singular gene, that caused this or that malady, and we could then, relatively simple, cure all those conditions. We have learned that most aspects of our and all life's biology is far more interconnected. Therefore, the fact that a gene evolved in different organisms makes the likelihood that a single swap gene could have a catastrophic effect in another very unlikely. That said, what kind of effect would be generated? The most likely victim would be the organism itself, perhaps causing a misfiring of internal operations. You would not see a harmful gene skip the host organism and only affect the person eating the GMO, which is essentially the claim of the anti-GM movement. So let's go back to our fish tomato. Another way that we could know it's safe is that we know what happens when you mix the fish proteins with the tomato proteins. How do we know? Ever had a fish sandwich with tomatoes? Maybe Boston fish chowder. Well, in these meals, you are mixing their guts together. In fact, it's worse because you are mixing way more than just one protein, but the whole suite. There's a guideline for this type of GM. It's referred to as substantial equivalence. Substantial equivalence embodies a concept that if a new food or food component is found to be substantially equivalent to an existing food or food component, it can be treated in the same manner with respect to safety. I.e., if the new food or food compound can be concluded as safe as the conventional food compound or component. So for example, if I breed a type of potato that is purple, it is basically the same potato I start out with. The original is deemed safe, and so the purple one is also deemed safe. This is a standard for crossbreeding for millennia. This just extends it to GM by saying if all the parts of the GM have been safe, then the combination is deemed to be safe. That said, it's not deemed safe automatically. This equivalence is determined by testing the GMO and seeing if there are new compounds not found in the original organism. If there are any notable increases in toxins, allergens, nutrients, etc. If they are basically the same, then the GMO is determined to be as safe as the original. And just in case it was not clear, back to our GMO tomato. The tomato has been around for a while and deemed safe to eat. The fish similarly has been on the dinner plate for years and is also safe. When tested, the fish tomato has no unexpected compounds. There's no difference in the level of compounds found in either fish or tomato. Ergo, the GMO tomato is deemed similarly safe. For those GMOs that are truly novel, such as a glow-in-the-dark cat, yes, true, not made up, it's a real thing, well, that would be deemed a new thing and have no substantial equivalents. We do not regularly eat glow-in-the-dark jellyfish, or cats for that matter. So this would have to undergo regulatory testing to prove they are safe for humans or animal consumption. And then there's, of course, the third line. Many of the truly novel gene mixes, well, these are being scientifically tested. They do have to be proven to be safe before they are approved. So they're not just thrown out there without anyone actually taking a look at their safety. In response to the fears raised by the anti-GMO movement, a number of scientists have tested to see if there is in fact any fire to their smoke. And the vast scientific consensus is that they are safe. Yes, some of the studies are paid for by companies, and that can raise eyebrows, but most of the work is done by scientists and institutions above reproach. And as I said, because of popular interest, a lot of the research is done by independents with no vested interests. And let's put a counterfactual. We can make analogies to pharmaceuticals. These are also tested, likely more vigorously than GMOs. Well, there have been instances where drugs were approved for use and then recalled when harmful side effects were revealed. And that's a good point, and I think proves the safety of the current stock of GMOs. If these were truly a source of drastic health effects that the anti-GMOers are claiming, and let's run down some of them, they claim tissue damage to kidneys and liver, well, really all organs, causing tumors, harming our immune system, prenatal defects, allergies, and of course cancer, among a whole host of other claims. Well, if such an apocalypse was being wrought on our society, well, we would all be suffering, or at least suffering enough to cause a recall. This is what happens when the pharmaceutical system fails. GMO foods, the ones claimed to be harmful, are so integrated into our food system, if any anti-GMO claim was true, well, we would not likely be around to hear it. It's important to note, the approval of GMOs by the scientific community is not universal or unconditional. As new issues arise, as new forms and combinations of GM are developed, they will also need to be proven safe. It's not a blank check. Okay, now some of you are likely shouting, what about the study I heard that showed GMOs will cause cancer? It'll make me allergic to meat, make me glow in the dark, ah! Not all scientists agree they are safe. To that I say, yes and no. To answer this question, I'm going to share with you something I heard on Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is one of the alternative news and media sources I like to call upon. I've played interviews on the show in the past as part of the Web Wisdom series. Well, they aired a segment about GMOs that I thought was a great case study in why the fact there is not 100% acceptance of GMO safety is not the same thing as saying that there's much debate in the scientific community about their safety. So first thing I noticed was the interviewee had written a book on the issue. Quote, "The GMO Deception. What you need to know about your food, the corporations and government agencies putting our families and our environment at risk." So there is a slight, but far from fatal irony that all the while he claims corporations have an economic bias on this issue, well, so does he. He wants to sell his book. Another ad hominem. Let's get those out of the way early so we can focus on the real arguments later. He falls into the classic demographic of conspiracy theory proliferators. He is late middle-aged, white, retired, and from an academic background, but not one in the focus area of the conspiracy. In this case, a physicist and philosopher. An odd combination, but regardless, not one related to plant biology nor genetics. Okay, so the interview starts off with a great question. That, like GMO, the vast majority of scientists believe that man-made climate change is occurring, and that this is in the face of deep-pocketed big oil. Why is the consensus right about climate change, but wrong about GMOs? The response was, and I quote, "Well, there are some independent scientists, and they have produced some animal studies on the effects of GMOs. And some of those studies have shown that the effects are not good. And every time a scientist produces such a study, they are vilified by other scientists and other people who are tied to the industry. So we can see from our own research that the science has been politicized. And there are many cases where we can show that scientists have been treated unfairly and unethically just because they have found negative outcomes with respect to animal studies. If I substitute animal for climate, well, you have a climate change denier. And he don't actually answer the question. Or if he did, it was to say, yes, global warming is as untrue as GMOs are safe, which he thinks GMOs are unsafe, therefore he must also be a climate change denier. The studies he mentioned, well, a number of them have already been covered on the show. The scientists involved were not vilified for the results, they were vilified for the shoddy methodology or the blatant politicalization of their work, as well as the shoddy methodology of their research. Now, one infamous example dealt with tumors in rats known as the Sarolin Affair, where you had a study funded by an anti-GMO group by an author who has a stated agenda of proving GMOs are dangerous. Not a good thing in a scientific experiment. That said, to be fair, it really doesn't say anything about the research because everyone is biased. Now, this research was biased, which is why the scientific methodology is so key and so important here. It is the one way we can reach past personal biases and achieve a true scientific consensus that is repeatable. But more on that later. Now, this research was criticized for being a very small sample size, increasing the possibility that the results were just sort of natural randomness. Why is sample size important? Well, let's say you flipped a coin and it landed heads up 10 times out of 15. You could honestly conclude that the coin was extremely pro-heads. Of course, if you increased your sample size, so now I flipped it 1,500 times, I now find it's a 740 to 760 tails to heads, which hardly seems a difference at all. So, Seralini used 200 rats in 20 categories or groupings. The OECD for studies like this recommend 50 per group. Seralini should have had 1,000 rats to make the study more reliable. In fact, because of the type of rat used, 1,300 rats would have met the scientific community's standards to make the claims he made. So, all things being equal, with such a small sample size, any results could be random, like coins landing heads 10 times in a row. Of course, you could argue that a pro-GMO results could have been just as likely, given that it was random, which is true. But how likely would it have been that this very biased author would have written up those results? And, to be fair to him, even if he did, well, it's kind of boring. So it would also have been unlikely anyone would have published it. So let's call that sin number one. The study attempted to measure the difference in tumors between groups fed GMO corn, 0%, 11%, 22%, and 33%, and those fed water laced with glyphosate, Roundup's active ingredient. A combination of laced water and GMO corn and a control group fed what I can only assume the researchers would have called wholesome corn. The entire study is premised on comparing various dose groups with the control groups that were not exposed to the GMO or glyphosate. And yet, the authors provide no statistical analysis of this comparison. Given the small number of rats in each group, it is likely that this lack of statistical analysis is due to the fact that statistical significance could not be reached. Essentially, he didn't do the mathy part that you're supposed to do to show that the numbers mean what they actually mean. Now, this study was published in a respectable publication, Food and Chemical Toxicology. That said, and often not mentioned by the anti-GMOers, it was also retracted with a statement that said, ultimately, the results presented, while not incorrect, are inconclusive and therefore do not reach the threshold of publication for Food and Chemical Toxicology. The retraction reads like a long excuse for the editorial failure of a journal, and it is disappointing, but at least they ultimately reached the correct conclusion. This paper should never have been published. It slipped through the cracks of peer review. So let's call this sin number two. Final sin is the choice of subject. They are not normal lab rats, but a species that was modified. Heavy sense of irony here. They were a GMO species that were created to be very susceptible to tumors. In fact, under untainted conditions, These rats spontaneously develop tumors anywhere from 70 to 90% of the time. Ergo, even if the numbers were as bad as implied, they would still fall within the noise level of the natural occurring tumors these rats were bred to produce. So let's call that sin number 4, and I think we're pretty much done here. Okay, so it seems that it was not the fact that the results were, quote, against Big Agra that this research was condemned. It was condemned because it was bad research. And there has yet to be presented repeatable research of a suitable standards that show what the GMO fearmongers claim. And this has been repeated for every study that I have seen that does claim that GMOs are toxic or hazardous to our health. Okay, another argument brought out is that there are strict restrictions on the use of GMOs, their labeling, and their planting in Europe, which is true. There are a number of European nations that have limited the use of GMOs, and some have banned their plantation in their nations. Why? Well, first, just because one nation does something, like the U.S.'s ban on haggis, does not mean there's something bad about haggis. And closer to home, baby walkers have been banned in Canada since 2004. The real question is why it was banned. Well, part of the answer lies in what is called a new thing. In most of the world, genes that exist in nature are deemed old things. So wheat, be it the one used by my grandfather or the new strain I crossbred last week, well, they have been in nature, so they are old things. They are deemed safe because they've been around for a long time. This includes the recombination of genes. There is a gene in fish that produces an enzyme that prevents freezing above minus 10 degrees Celsius. I take that gene and I put it into a tomato. Now the enzyme is made in tomato and it becomes frost resistant. We've kind of covered this already. Most of the world looks at this and says, we have eaten fish for generations. We've eaten tomatoes for as long. Therefore, the combination is considered to be an old thing and no new testing is needed. Again, beyond the testing to make sure there's nothing unexpected chemically in the combination or the like. In Europe, if this combination was done in a lab or if the food was irradiated, it is considered a new thing. Side note, irradiated food is food that has been exposed to low levels of radiation to sterilize the food, thus preventing rotting. This does not make the food radioactive. It does destroy DNA, thus killing bacteria and thus sterilization. Why is irradiated food considered a new thing in Europe? The only explanation I can think of is Hiroshima, or the irrational fear of anything radioactive. Irradiated food is no more radioactive than the food I put into the microwave oven. In fact, if they ban irradiated food, one must wonder why they allow people to have x-rays. That will have far more impact on people's health than irradiated foods. I guess my point is, a lot of legislation in Europe is not based on science, but hysteria. So let's return to what's a new thing. So most of the world believes a new thing must be new, not in Europe. I find it humorous that people will say, giving my example, quote, they put a fish gene into a tomato. Well, it's humorous to me is because why they would call it a fish gene at all. As we discussed earlier, all life shares genes, and really is not the gene that is to worry about, but the possible effects of the enzyme the gene produces. And to repeat myself, people have eaten fish with the gene and the enzyme with no harmful effects. They've eaten fish with tomatoes, that is the chemical and enzymes of the tomatoes and the fish having mixed together. We've eaten this for generations and not been affected. It is an old thing, not a new thing. The way the anti-GMOers have it, when they say we need to test it to prove it is safe because it's in a new location, well, that's like saying I cannot consider batteries safe in a flashlight because batteries have only been previously used in radios. Now, the next ploy they use is to, again, let me quote the interviewee. I found 22 studies have shown that the animals that are fed GMOs have some negative effect. We don't know whether these 22 studies will stand up when they're retried, but nobody can tell us that these studies in peer-reviewed journals are not important or relevant. And sometimes the few negative studies that you have are more important than the dozens of positive studies, which show nothing. I did a quick check. There are well over 2,000 studies showing no ill effects of GMOs. And they claim that, quote, a few negative studies, are more important than a dozen positive studies, well, that's antithetical to the scientific method. The reason we trust and rely on the scientific method is that it is repeatable and self-correcting. When he states that no one can tell us that their studies are not important, well, yes, we can, because they are at best anomalies and at worst fraudulent. That is why science does not go with the popular or ideological, but with the repeatable, and so far GMO seems safe. Then, of course, you get the bait and switch. It is not GMOs that are bad, but the evil multinational corporations that are promoting them that are evil. Therefore, GMOs must be evil, because a corporation can only promote evil. No? Well, I agree with the first part. I think corporations are a blight on society. And if it were not for the anti-scientific message of the anti-GMOers, I might hold my nose and agree with them. But as much of a communist as I may be, the damage done by the anti-GMOers, well, it's as bad as climate change deniers or the anti-vaxxers. You might say, but Don, they're not anti-GMO, but merely reluctant or cautious GMOers. Remember the precautionary principle? That is, they only want to see proof of safety before proceeding. That is why they want labeling. Fair enough, until I change the context. The anti-vax movement says that they had nothing against vaccinations, but before they are used on helpless children, note the addition of an irrelevant but powerfully emotive child element, they need to be tested for safety. And on the surface, that sounds very reasonable, perhaps even prudent. The problem is shifting goalposts. As I already stated, there have been already thousands of studies proving the safety of GMOs. How many studies are enough? It reminds me of the creationists who keeps asking for the, quote, missing link. You produced a link, and they said, well, what about the one between us and that one, ad infinitum? Of course, another ploy used in the interview was appeal to authority. Some of these 22 studies, or 1% of all studies, were published in magazines such as The Lancet, which, to be fair, is seen as a top-rated premier publication. If it's published there, you must assume the paper and its science significant. You would if you weren't actually exposed to the anti-vax movement. And you recalled they, The Lancet, published and eventually retracted a completely fraudulent paper by Andrew Wakefield, which spawned the modern anti-vax movement. For those not in the know, Wakefield published a report that autism was linked to vaccination, but forgot to mention that he was paid to do this study by lawyers who were suing a pharmaceutical over the vaccines, and that he had a competing vaccine that he was attempting to commercialize. This is now a case study on how the system can go wrong. Okay, so now the big question, where things turn from black and white to shades of gray. Should GMOs products be labeled? As I think I've already discussed, practically everything in our grocery store has been genetically manipulated. Remember the banana episode we did on Radio Free Thinker not that long ago? What anti-GMOers want labeled as GMO is fuzzy and has more to do with a political agenda than a medical or scientific one. Okay, so if they're not going to bring a good argument, let's Iron Man this argument. So the question should be, should transgenic organisms that are manipulated in a lab be labeled as GMOs? Well, on the one hand, this does not seem beyond the pale, unreasonable. But one must ask why. Wait, before I go there, I do want to take off the table an argument against GMO labeling that I have heard and I agree is ridiculous. The corporations have argued that labeling would cost millions of dollars and that it's an unreasonable cost. Well, first, that argument can be stated that we should not put seatbelts in cars because the cost would be too great. And after all, we got along for decades without them. Also, as an anti-corporatist, anti-capitalist communist, I have no problem with regulations, provided it suits a purpose and is not red tape for red tape's sake. And one must wonder, why are corporations so worried about putting GMOs on their labels? Are they worried that their Agenda 21 plan to kill off most of the population in aid of some global domination plot? Obama, are you at it again? No, there is no plot beyond the age-old one, profit. Corporations know that sales of their product will suffer if they are labeled GMO. Why? Well, as we've already covered, it is not because of the potential health effects, but because of the poisoned environment the anti-GM movement has created. You saw a similar thing with vaccinations. In the late 90s, Thermosol, a preservative containing mercury, a safe for human form of mercury, was reduced to trace amounts or removed from vaccines for children. Why? Because the anti-vax movement had so poisoned the well that people thought the presence of mercury in vaccines, well, that it was the bad kind. This mistake is akin to confusing dihydrogen dioxide with hydrogen dioxide, i.e. peroxide and water. Anyway, the compound was needlessly removed because of anti-vax propaganda. This is what food producers are worried about and that will happen if they have to label products as GMO. And I would agree. I was thinking of an interesting parallel between GMO labeling and organic labeling. Each are equally useless to the consumer. And yet, because of the propaganda of the anti-science type, one is seen as a panacea for all our ills and the other condemned as the root of all our ills. Why do I say useless? Well, if you look behind what the anti-GMOers are really against, it's not organisms themselves. No, they're against Monsanto for patenting genes. And so am I. They're against the use of pesticides and herbicides. They want the ethical treatment of animals. They are against the unmitigated greed of modern multinational corporations. You're preaching to the choir here, folks. But none of this has anything to do with the safety of my frost-resistant tomatoes. And there is an irony to this. The anti-GMOers will either win and a needless label will be applied to food, or they will not and they will continue to profit as prophets of genetic doom. Oh yes, I was mentioning organic food. It's interesting how such producers are clamoring to get the organic label on their food. Why? Because they know the ill-informed will see the label as a good thing and will pay more for the said product, even if it's no better than the non-organic comrade. But I'm not going to go off on a rant that organic crops that use cyanide as pesticide are okay, well, one that uses a far safer non-organic certified chemicals is toxic. No, but I do have some advice perhaps for the anti-GMOers. Use that win, the organic one, as where you should put your efforts. Get corporations to put GMO-free labels on their products. Like with organic foods, only the moneyed elite can afford this fictional luxury, and the rest of us can get on with living our life. Well, I think I've said everything I wanted to say about this. I'd be really interested to know what your comments are. Please let me know. You can email me at info@radiofreethinker.com. And, well, I think that's all we have time for this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, most first, invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose.
Night's work well done, and so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pick my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart Play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
There are two ways of thinking of a robot. One is the science fiction robot. is a science fiction robot because he looks like us, behaves like us, and does things like us. Is the robot who actually drives the car because it has a body like ours and can drive from here to there because it reasons like us, he has our skills. That is, as I said, science fiction. Then there's the other robot, the robot that doesn't look like us, doesn't think like us, doesn't behave like us, but it can actually drive the car from here to there because there's plenty of information, maps, sensors, satellite, and controls of all kinds, together with algorithms and databases that make sure that the particular journey is successful. That is the robot that's going to be successful in the future, because we are enveloping the world around its very simple abilities. We saw in the other video how time is changing in terms of hyperhistory. I'd like to tell you something about how our conception of space is changing, and therefore in terms of how environment is being shaped today. This has got to do with the success of artificial intelligence, AI, or as I rather would call it, smart technologies. Suppose we want to summarize the history of AI in the past 60 years or so. It would look something like this. You have, on the one end, AI as part of the engineering department. This means that it doesn't matter whether there's really AI. What it matters is that it does a good job. The joke is, don't ask whether a submarine can actually swim as long as it does what it's supposed to do. Is it really swimming or not? That's not the issue. Or you could have AI as part of the cognitive science department. At this point, it is not about the job. It's about the non-biological implementation of intelligence. Maybe it's just a little bit of intelligence and it's not as intelligent as your dog, but it would be an enormous success if he were intelligent at all. Now, this has been a great success. This has been a complete disaster. We have no intelligence whatsoever to speak in terms of AI today, as you would expect it from a cognitive science perspective. But we have amazing smart machines. In terms of engineering, the sky's the limit. There are more and more machines, more and more computers of all kinds doing things that we thought were impossible just yesterday. So what's the explanation? Well, the explanation is something that I would like to call enveloping the world. The term comes from robotics, and it's quite simple. The best thing to do is to introduce it with an analogy. You have several robots in your kitchen. They're called dishwasher, fridge, and so on. Now, a dishwasher does exactly what happens in an industrial building. You build a whole world around a very simple gadget inside. What you do is to transform a whole environment into something that is friendly to the very stupid little robot inside, who goes, no, choo-choo-choo-choo-chunk, with a little bit of soap, for a long time. Nobody in his right mind, certainly not me, would wash the dishes the way a dishwasher does it. Don't even try this at home. You have your agent here, which is quite stupid, and you have a complex environment here. Instead of trying to make the agent adapt to the environment, you make the environment friendly to the stupid agent. You build a whole box around some turning bits and a bit of soap, or